Napoli, where love is king, when boy meets girl, here's what they say.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling, and you'll sing Vita Bella. Hearts will play tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a guitar and when the stars make you drool, just like a pastifazool, that's amore. When you dance down the street with a cloud at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. Excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore.
When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore.
That's amore.
Bells will ring,
ting-a-ling-a-ling,
ting-a-ling-a-ling,
and you'll sing Vita Bella.
Vita Bella, Vita Bella. Hearts will play
tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a gay tarantella.
Lucky fella.
When the stars make you drool just like pasta puzzle,
that's amore.
That's amore. When you dance down the street with the cloud at your feet, you're in love.
When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. Excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore,
amore,
that's amore.
Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at axissacramento.org. Or you can hear this program and previous programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Facing Disaster in the Middle East with Stephen Kinzer. American and European policies in the Middle East have produced a region immersed in violence, terror, anger, and oppression. The West needs to change policies that were shaped for the Cold War. Kinzer offers ideas for a better approach to the world's most turbulent region. And then after that, toxic lead still in brass plumbing. Officials at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill tested water coming from new brass plumbing in some of the college's new buildings and found it contains high levels of lead.
Lead in white, please.
Sandra Hunt, with an interest in the Middle East and having visited most of the countries, but the last speaker has actually essentially asked my question. I would just like to add perhaps that certainly at the moment it appears as if things are moving away from the sort of proposals you're making, in that Israel does seem to be moving more to the right, acting against her own civil rights groups in there. And America also appears to be moving the Tea Party, etc., further to the right. I would dearly like to believe in your approach. Do you think there is, in the current circumstances, any chance of that materializing?
I would say that for this to materialize, there would have to be a decision at the highest level of the U.S. government. The president would have to decide this. This could not be done at any lower level. And in American political culture, that would have to be something that a president would do in a second term. We may have a president who may be reelected for a second term. He has not up to now shown any inclination to make dramatic changes in foreign policy. In fact, I don't think Barack Obama has ever devoted concentrated amounts of thought to questions of global security. He's never had a job where he had to do that up until becoming president. He's devoted a lot of thought to domestic issues like labor and environment and energy, but not to these issues. And the people he has around him are very conventional. They are the straitjacket that imprisons us. But I'll just add one other thing. Of course, Israel's a sovereign country. It makes its own policies. So do we. But I had to roll my eyes the other day when I saw the Israeli prime minister appealing to the United States to do Israel the favor of pardoning Jonathan Pollard, this Israeli spy who's in prison in the U.S. And I thought to myself, they kick the sand in our face every day. They poke their fingers in our eyes, whatever adjective or metaphor you want to use. And that's their choice. But then when they want to come to us and say, by the way, we'd like a favor from you, I had to ask myself, how do you spell chutzpah?
You mentioned the democratic nature of Iran, and yet the impression that we get from here certainly is that Ahmadinejad fiddled the election last year. And when you're talking about the future for the country, you didn't mention Ahmadinejad at all. And certainly the impression we get in the West that he's not the person whom we would think is a reasonable person to negotiate with. He comes out with all this vitriol and hatred and talks about the Zionist entity and so forth. So where you're talking about Iran and the US talking to each other and the US opening itself to Iran, are you suggesting that that would be possible with the current Iranian regime, or are you saying, well, maybe in a few years' time it may be possible for the US to find people whom we in the West would consider sufficiently reasonable to negotiate with?
I think it may take a few years' time. On the other hand, the clock is ticking in this relationship. The centrifuges are spinning. If we take that nuclear threat as seriously as we claim to be taking it, I believe we should be acting with an appropriate urgency. Now, if we did so, what response would there be on the other side? I don't think we know that yet. I wouldn't say that President Ahmadinejad holds the power that we associate with the word president. He's not the final decision maker in Iran. In fact, the Iranian political system is quite opaque, and we don't really know how the shifting alliance is working. I think it's changing very dramatically, even as we speak. Now, I don't think it's an easy sell for an American president to get up and say, it's time for us to embrace the Israel-hating, Holocaust-denying, demonstrator-shooting, women-stoning president of Iran. A possibly more productive approach would be to use the argument of national interest. Let's put aside our stereotypes, and in this case, as with most stereotypes, this one is based on a certain amount of truth, and let's ask ourselves, what's good for us? We want stability in the Middle East. I don't think it's right for us, as I said earlier, to make such concessions to the regime that we seem to be betraying people who support our ideals in Iran. I think even after Ahmadinejad leaves the scene, which I think is going to happen after the next election, that confluence is not necessarily going to change. So I hold no brief for him, and he's certainly not the ideal negotiating partner. We don't even know if he would be the negotiating partner. But I would say my two-part answer is, on the one hand, we probably, if we're looking for a real long-term agreement, would have to wait for some evolution in that regime, maybe not the end of it, but some evolution. But secondly, it's too urgent to wait, and we should at least try.
Okay, at the back there, and then at the front.
Yes, you dismissed the U.S.-Saudi relationship because the two countries were culturally so different. But surely, in geopolitical terms, they're inextricably linked, because the Saudis need the American defense umbrella, and the Americans need the Saudi control over the oil price. And just looking further, you seem to be looking for a Middle East where the is dominated by all the countries that previously have dominated the Arabs, with Turkey, Iran, Israel, and America in charge, and you make no mention whatsoever of the Arab states.
Very thoughtful question. Thank you. First of all, you talked about the basis for the U.S.-Saudi relationship. It is true that Saudi Arabia looks very intensely for the U.S. defense umbrella. Nonetheless, if the situation geopolitically were to change in the Middle East, maybe such an intense and expensive umbrella might not be necessary anymore. You also talked about our reliance on Saudi oil. This is true. We get about 11% of our oil from Saudi Arabia. This is not a habit we're going to break anytime soon. If it were to become more difficult for us to obtain Saudi Arabian oil in the future, I wouldn't shed too many tears for that. America really needs a kick in the pants to try to break this oil addiction, and that might be something that we would need. But I want to add one other factor you didn't mention, which I think is increasingly vital, tying the U.S. To Saudi Arabia, and that is the huge amounts of money that Saudi Arabia spends in the U.S. buying weapons. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia have recently signed the largest arms deal in the history of the human race. $60 billion worth of American arms are now going to be going to Saudi Arabia. Now, the way this works in the U.S. is very clever. These arms manufacturers, the first thing they do is they split up the contract and they give it to different districts of congressmen who are influential in the U.S. I come from Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, we have 100,000 jobs relying on the defense industry. Our Secretary of Defense is trying to kill a highly unnecessary Marine landing vehicle. The senators and congressmen from Ohio and Indiana are bitterly opposing this. That's where they're going to make this stuff. So the Saudis, through the arms manufacturers from which they buy their armaments, have a very tight hold on the American political system. And it would be a very brave American politician who would get up and say, the hundreds of thousands of jobs that are going to be created by this Saudi arms purchase are not worth it. We should forget. We don't want those jobs at the situation we're in now. Very, very difficult thing to say. So I think that is part of the tie. Now, your second part of your question had to do with Arabs. What is the role of Arabs in all of this? First of all, you're right that historically Turks and Iranians have been, for various reasons, separate from Arabs. Nonetheless, I do think that Iranians in particular, and to a certain extent Turks, are betting now on forces in the Middle East that are popular. They are betting on the Shiite parties in Iraq. They are betting on Hamas. They are betting on Hezbollah. These are forces that win elections. We are betting on Pharaoh regime in Egypt and Mahmoud Abbas. These are not popular figures. So although Iran is the target of much anger from Arab leaders, I don't think there's that much resentment of them on the part of ordinary Arabs. And I think, in fact, many of them admire what Iran has been able to do in its support for groups that it backs in the Middle East, and that they tremendously admire Turkey now more than they ever did, largely as a result of the Gaza episode. So although I would see angry reaction from some Arab leaders, I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing. Any kind of change in Middle East geopolitics is going to upset Arab governments, and a peace between Israel and the Palestinians would fundamentally destabilize every Arab government because they'd lose that bloody shirt to wave around. But these are relationships that are all based on common interest between elites. I don't believe you would see a generalized uprising or wave of anger in the Arab world if the United States would try to deepen its relationship with Iran and intensify its relationship with Turkey.
One question I have, although it borders on a lot of things, America's on its last legs financially. We all know that. It's overextended itself in its war fronts. It can't fight a war. It seems to want to be opening another war. What will it take to get people at home to stop and think and change? I mean, at the moment, the Clintonistas seem to have taken over the administration. How that happened, I don't know. What games they played, but he won't leave the stage. He seems to be still having Blair on the stage. Blair is that sort of special peace envoy to the Middle East. But what will it change? Because will China have to pull the plug?
I recently heard that the only hope to save us would be Oprah Winfrey, and since she's so rich, China owes her money. We are spending $1 trillion a year in Afghanistan. We are involved in what the Bush administration called the Global War on Terror, which has now been rebranded as Overseas Contingency Operations. And it's increasingly clear that this global reach is not financially sustainable. The United States maintains over 700 military bases around the world. We still have 75,000 soldiers in Germany. What are we protecting Germany against? We have 11 carrier groups. No other country has more than one. How long can this continue? Well, I think what I foresee in the United States is that we're going to continue with this fiction that we can have everything we want domestically and everything we want abroad. And then when cuts need to be made, the cuts will all be made domestically in order to maintain what we call full spectrum dominance. Then, ultimately, I could imagine some kind of a reaction from inside the United States saying, our bridges and roads are falling apart. Our people right now, while we're spending $1 trillion a year in Afghanistan, our students are number 20 in the world in math and science. That can't go on forever. And then, if we come to realize that there has to be some decision-making, some triage, something has to go, I could imagine that possibly Americans would begin to rethink this exceptionalist idea that we need to, we see the world as a place that needs to be managed, and we're the ones that God has chosen to do the managing. Ultimately, this is not sustainable. And I think that there will come a point at which the right-left divide will break down. This was sustainable during the Cold War. The right wanted, never saw a war they didn't like, and the left always wanted to cut military expenditures. But if the right truly wants to adopt the policies of prudence and moderation and conservatism, and if these new insurgents on the so-called far right really want to be radical, this is the way for them to be radical, is to challenge this American idea that we're the ones that need to manage the world. If we can challenge that, we'll not only have political benefit to ourselves, but we might be able to avoid the financial disaster to which you refer.
There's a question at the back, and then two at the front here. So there was a hand. Was it yours? Okay.
Hi, my name is John. I'm a postgraduate here at the LSE. So you mentioned the population in Iran is pro-US, and I think there are a lot of indications that show that amongst polling data. But I guess my question is, what makes you think that the government or the religious elites in Iran would set aside their own interests? They're part of, I guess, an aspirant regional hegemon, set aside their own interests to work, to compromise and work collectively with the U.S. to try to limit political violence. You cited Iraq as an example. I think that I was kind of reminded when Muqtada al-Sadr recently returned to Iraq that Iran has sort of a long history over the last decade of supporting Shia groups that were trying to destabilize Iraq more than they were probably trying to bring stability outside their local areas within certain regions in Iraq. And when we saw the Sunni awakening, some of those leaders that try to rein in some of the Sunnis, they were the same ones that the Shia militant groups were targeting just prior to that. So Iran showed an interest in promoting instability when it's within or in accordance with their interests. What makes you think that they would kind of move away from their interests to work collectively against those that are different?
Well, first of all, instability is in the mind of the beholder. Iran would say they are promoting stability. It's the United States that's promoting instability. You can argue it either way. But certainly the return of Muqtada al-Sadr is yet another indication of one of the major geopolitical developments in that part of the world in the last decade, which is that we Americans gave Iraq to Iran on a platter. Iraq was the principal rival of Iran. As long as Iraq was strong and united, Iran could not rise in power. We are the ones who gave Iran the great prize that Iran could never achieve on its own. So this was our great enemy that we self-defeatingly, tremendously empowered. Now, I wouldn't expect Iran to compromise its own interests. What I would like to do is do what diplomats are supposed to do, which is to understand the other person and make the other side realize that what's in our interest could also be in your interest. A stable Iraq is certainly in the interest of both sides. But you're touching on what I think is the main reason why the United States cannot up to now, make some kind of arrangement with Iran that would help stabilize Iraq. And I think that agreement is within reach. But there's one caveat. Any agreement like that carries implicit within it the recognition of Iran as an important regional power. And the United States is not ready to confer that status on Iran. My answer would be, you don't have to confer it on Iran. Iran already has this status. That might be a bad thing. You can argue about that. That's a separate argument. But that's there. Iran is going to be the dominant country in that part of the world for many, many years to come. We should recognize that reality. In order to do so, we would have to compromise. We're asking Iran to make compromise. But we would also have to compromise with Iran. We are not ready to do that yet. And until we are, I don't see any possibility of this kind of rapprochement. But if there could be one place to start, I think Iraq would be a great one. I can think of many others. Iran has the world's greatest heroin problem now as a result of imports coming over from Afghanistan. The United States is so eager to work on stopping the poppy trade out of Afghanistan. This would be a great area for cooperation. So you don't necessarily have to require either country to put aside its interests. What you have to do is require them to put aside their emotions and see the extent to which their long-term interests coincide. And these are state interests that do not change as regimes change.
Yes.
I'm an ex-student of the LSE, and I am also a reader of The Independent, and I'm very interested in the Middle East. I have also visited Israel. I would like to say, you haven't really addressed the issue of Hamas, which is a growing influence now in the Middle East, and the problem of settlements, which is in fact a firing thorn in the flesh of most of our terrorists, I think. And I think that this is one of the most urgent questions that you have got to address as Americans.
I agree with you that the settlement problem in the West Bank is fundamental to this whole conundrum. In fact, one of the either frustrating or intriguing aspects of this terrible complex of problems in the Middle East is that they're all interwoven. In one sense, it's frustrating because it makes you think you can't solve one without solving so many others. On the other hand, maybe trying to make a break somewhere can lead then, like dominoes, to making breaks in other places. And I would argue that a U.S.-Iran rapprochement would be the beginning. Now, you're absolutely right that not only is the settlement project an obstacle to peace, but it is a principal reason for the radicalization of not just Palestinians, but the whole Middle East. In fact, it's remarkable to me to the extent to which Palestinians have resisted even further radicalization under these circumstances. In fact, it is exactly intense frustration over Gaza, specifically, that has led the Turks and Prime Minister Erdogan to their new policy toward Israel. It's not anti-Semitism or anti-Israel feeling. It is an intense antipathy to the settlement project in the West Bank and the occupation and encirclement of Gaza. And that's what led to the flotilla episode. And that is what has made the Turks so popular in the Arab world, including in many countries where they haven't been popular in the past. Hamas is an example of the forces I referred to earlier when I said Turkey can talk to people that we can't talk to yet. There is never going to be a peace accord between the Palestinians and the Israelis to which Hamas is not a party. So they have to be involved at some point. Again, this is a question of facing unpleasant reality, like facing Iranian power in the Middle East.
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
The color of the day is orange, the terror risk is high. They never tell us why, just be prepared. We're never told just how or when or who might be our foe. And everyone I know is really scared. But they finally have a tip for you and me. The solution to surviving World War III. All you need is duct tape. Everything's gonna be alright. Get saran wrap from the drawer and seal your windows tight. Don't you worry about anthrax, dirty bombs, smallpox, radon. When all is said and done, the war on terrorism's gonna be won with duct tape. My 401k's in the tank, my kid's school's falling down, and all these clowns can talk about is war. Well, there's one or two things here to do, like jobs for you and me. Homeland security means so much more. But when the questions get a little tough,
They have an answer just obtuse enough. All you need is duct tape to hold your tattered life intact. Everyone ducked and covered. It'll save you, that's a fact. Don't you worry about education, healthcare, retirement, dirty air. Everything's okay. Trust us, they all say. And get duct tape. I've used it on my car, and I fixed my garden hose. I've removed a wart or two, gotten lint right off my clothes. It's worked on almost everything I've tried to use it for. So I guess it stands to reason it'll work just great for war. Talking about duct tape. You know, every time I turn on my radio, my TV, everything I hear and see just makes me wonder. These guys who'll never face a risk, so quick to draw the sword. In every deed and word, they reel and blunder. So when you're tired of their pontification, there's one surefire fix for our nation. All you need is duct tape, and just plaster it across their lips. All these armchair warriors shooting from their hips. When you had enough Fox News, Falwell, Limbaugh, George Will, spreading lies and fears, just cover up your ears with duct tape. And when you had enough W, Ashcroft, Rumsfeld, spouting off till it makes you sick, just tell them where they can stick their duct tape.
Now for something completely different.